طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we critically examine the role and responsibility of American Jews to confront the established Jewish organizations, the Jewish lobby, and local synagogues concerning the apartheid state of Israel and its military occupation of the Palestinian people. Our Congress and government officials will not back away from the sickening support they give to Israel until enough of us challenge the chokehold that the Jewish establishment, like AIPAC and other Jewish political PACs, have on Congress because of the enormous amount of money they pay into the electoral process. To guide us through this conversation, we hear from Dorothy Zellner, a civil rights movement icon, and Phil Weiss, co-founder of the news service Mondo Weiss. They both grew up in Jewish families and have become leaders in the movement to confront the Jewish establishment and the Zionist movement concerning the occupation of Palestine and the continuing illegal theft of Palestinian land. Here we go. A conversation with Dorothy Zellner and Phil Weiss.
So it's my great pleasure today to be talking with Dorothy Zellner. Dorothy and I are old friends. Dorothy helped get me into Gaza 13 years ago, played a really important role in my life then, and met on several other occasions since. And Dorothy is a longtime activist. She lives in New York City. Her activist life began, as far as I know, with her involvement in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s, the great radical movement that helped liberate the South, somewhat anyway. Dorothy and I also engage on the Jewish question, the ways that the Jewish community is changing or not on the Israel-Palestine issue. And I know, I just want to say before I this is going to be a Dorothy talking mostly, and we're going to have a conversation, but before I turn it over to you, Dorothy, I just want to say, I know that a lot of listeners of ours and a lot of our audience is a little impatient sometimes with the intra-Jewish discussion, and that's okay. You know, it reflects certain privilege that Jews have in this discussion, and also I think an onus that Jews have because of our role in Zionism. So I just want to clear my throat a little and say, yeah, I understand that there's some impatience, but this is a very important community in terms of resolving this question. And that's the reason we go at this. And so I'm going to segue from that to this issue that much smaller issue, but a very important issue that we're concerned with, which is the Israel-Palestine question in the United States and in American politics. And I guess I'm wondering what optimism you have about that movement.
Well, just to go back a little bit to the segue, what made Black Lives Matter so incredibly important was, as I said, the numbers of white people who were ready to leave their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And when that happens in a majority, not for long, but a majority white country, it's very meaningful. The same with Israel-Palestine. That changes in the Jewish community here will make and are making a tremendous difference. Tell me again.
Wait, just to follow your analogy for a moment, you're saying that the Jews are sort of the white people in that.
I see.
Okay.
Exactly.
And that you said that in the 60s, some white allies were quiet and then even ran for their lives because they were betraying their own.
In the race. South. Yes, definitely. In the South. Yes.
Okay. That brings me to this. So to frame it in those terms, it's a helpful way to frame it for me. You and I have both been accused at various times of being traitors to our community, the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And so I would like you to tell our listeners your opinion about a couple of questions. And I mean this for our Jewish listeners, our non-Jewish listeners, everybody. I'm curious about this question. How Zionist is, there are sort of three related questions, I guess. How cohesive is the Jewish community? And when I say cohesive, how much of a sort of a groupthink is there inside the Jewish community? How Zionist is the Jewish community? And how much of a betrayal is it to say, I'm against Zionism in the Jewish community?
Okay, so keep those three questions in mind because I'm not writing anything down.
Sure.
I guess I'm more interested in the betrayal issue.
Okay.
First of all, people don't realize that Zionism was not the mainstream idea in the Jewish community until about 1940.
Okay.
So for our history, we are a diasporic people. Mm-hmm. We have been everywhere. We have gone everywhere. Sometimes we moved on our own. Sometimes we were kicked out and we had to move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everything we learned in that experience was how to get along with other people and how to exist side by side with our own cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are still a diasporic people, and we became majoritarian under conditions of extreme duress, the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of guilt that people have is based on the Holocaust. It's not that you're so much a traitor to your own people. You're a traitor to the people who died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's from their point of view.
You're in the context of Zionism.
Yes, in the context of Zionism. I think that any...
And just to be clear, when you say majoritarian, you're referring to the Jewish community
inside Israel. Yes.
Israel. Okay,
The Jewish community worldwide...
Yes, is diasporic.
Is diasporic. And at times, the Jews in the United States have equaled the Jews in Israel in numbers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a homeland, which people are telling us we all belong to, and half of us are not going. Half of us, to begin with. Mm-hmm. This is a failure of a state that claims that it represents all Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It acknowledges that half of us don't want to go there and don't want to be citizens there.
Mm-hmm. More than half, I think.
And, well, it's 14. I think it's split really down the middle. Down the middle, maybe 7 million don't go, and there are 7 million there.
But that's just the United States. We're not talking about England, Australia.
Yes, but the others altogether are,
Continue.
So Zionism is relatively new, even though, you know, it started in the 1890s. It's relatively new in the 3,000 years that we've been on Earth. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I personally don't believe that any ethnic state is a stable state.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a state that gives full citizenship to people of one ethnicity, there is bound to be instability because the other ethnicities are going to
I agree with you, and that's one of the funny things about learning about this issue is, like, wait, the Palestinians are not Zionists. Why should they be Zionists? They should be anti-Zionists. That's completely anyway. But yeah.
So this stable states, yeah, actually, to one degree or another, give citizenship, and a little statement that we should really love in the United States, since we taught from earliest childhood, we actually believe in equal rights. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. How is it that when you get a state like Israel, you throw equal rights out of the window? Mm-hmm. That is a contradiction that will bring them to the end. I mean, I actually think that no matter what we do, sooner or later, that is a state that is unstable.
I agree with you.
Because, right, it's either equal rights for everyone, or it is a privileged state where people will fight and struggle forever. And if you read any kind of history, no matter who the historian is, people struggle.
Yes, they have been struggling in Palestine for over 70
years. And they're going to keep on struggling.
They will keep struggling.
No matter what is thrown at them. So what I learned basically in the civil rights movement is, if you want to be an ally of an oppressed group, your role is not organizing the oppressed group. They know how to organize themselves. Your job is to organize in the oppressor group. That's where you can move freely, and that's where you can talk to people. Mm-hmm. So that's why I chose to become an activist on this subject. Mm-hmm. Because SNCC, it was my training in SNCC that SNCC asked the white people to organize, mm-hmm, in the white community. And what was my community by birth? It was being a Jew. Now, yes, I'm not religious, yes, but I consider myself very identified as a Jew and as a cultural Jew. Mm-hmm. So that's why it became primary for me, mm-hmm, that if I could advance the world movement towards equal rights, this is where I should do, mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like you to talk more about your family. I had an unusual family situation because my parents did not object to what I was saying, and they supported, mm-hmm, what I was doing. But many parents of other white people were miserable to the point where they even intervened physically and flew south and tried to drag their children out, you know, by the elbows. That's what I see as the basis of organizing in the Jewish community.
Wow, that's
and
great.
It also means that the Jewish community cannot survive, never has survived as a lockstep community where everybody was required to believe the same thing. Mm-hmm. This is why, culturally speaking, we all have internal jokes about two Jews, three parties.
Yeah.
I mean, that Jews love to argue. They love to debate. Even if you're not a Hasidic person, you know that people spend hours every day. They're thrilled to debate. But somehow it's a total shutdown when it comes to this.
So I want to get right back to that point, but I just want to bring up one public service announcement, which is that, apropos of activism, that yesterday Khalil Awada, a Palestinian hunger striker, ended his hunger strike after 182 days, after photographs went around the world of this man as a skeleton who went from 190 pounds to 80 pounds. The bravery of that man, who was in administrative detention without charges under Israel's control, the bravery of that man should be inspiring to activists around the world. This is, I assume, a humble person who was not highly educated. I don't know. Four children. These Palestinians, they know what they are doing, as you said about other activists. So I just want to acknowledge that the roles that we are playing in the United States in this struggle sort of pale next to the idea of giving up food for 280 days. I mean, I just want to emphasize, mm-hmm, that. Okay. Back to the question about organizing the Jewish community. You said Jews are not lockstep traditionally. How lockstep And you said also said that it is inside the Jewish community, it's something of a betrayal of the Holocaust. You're a traitor to the Holocaust when you say you're against Zionism. I want to get a feeling. I can offer my opinion on this, but how orthodox is the Jewish community in the United States? This, however, I don't know, 8 million people, what are they? How orthodox, how many of them are Zionists? How strong is that fervent, is that belief in that community?
Well, I'm not sure of the polls. You'd have to check those polls if there's such a thing. I would just say, just looking at the Jewish press and looking at, you know, the powerful Jewish organizations, I'd have to say that Zionism, it's about 80% of the community.
Wow. Okay.
I would say. I could be totally wrong. The difference is that it used to be 95%.
Wow.
Or 98%.
When?
Well, up until maybe 20 years ago. Up until when JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, took off.
Uh-huh.
Which is why I think it was one of the historical game changers, that organization will go down in history. Just like SNCC will go down in history. JVP will go down in history. Now, I'm making wild, you know.
I love it. I love it. You're smart. Look, we're talking because you're a highly intelligent person. You've been around. I'm not caught talking to a pollster. I don't want to talk to a pollster.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that it's 80%. And, you know, if you go into most synagogues, you will see in the kindergarten drawings on the wall that say, I love Israel.
Yes. You know,
for four-year-olds.
Yes.
And it starts then. And in the one of the organizations that I'm in, Jews Say No, you know, we made tremendous attempts to get into synagogues to have debates.
Uh-huh. And what happened?
Very little success. And not only very little success, I mean, outright misbehavior on the part of some rabbis who would accept a check, you know, to rent a room to have a discussion or a presentation. And then the night before tell the, you know, that we couldn't come.
And why were they saying that, do you think?
Well,
why were they going against their word?
They figured out who we were. We were not Zionists. We were Jews, all right. Nobody ever said to me I wasn't a Jew.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we weren't Zionists. And this was really threatening to them. Now, I want to make a shout out to some of the work that's subsidiary to JVP, but just to let your listeners know that there is such a thing as an anti-Zionist synagogue in the United States.
Yes.
And that is... The rabbi there is Brant Rosen.
Right.
And after many years of discussion, they decided they were not in favor of Zionism as a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, it's the only one in the United States and maybe in the world. I don't know. But it's not the last, for sure. It's not the last. And I think it's going to free people from this attitude. You know, I can be a Jew without being a Zionist.
Okay. It's slow progress, I would observe. And just to prod you on this, I want to quote a young woman talking to Americans for Peace Now earlier this summer about her future. And Americans for Peace Now is a liberal Zionist organization. It's not anti-Zionist. And this young person who Claire Davidson Miller, who identifies as liberal Zionist, I'm pretty sure, but questions Israeli politics. She said, and wants to be a rabbi. She said, I am terrified of what my Israel politics will mean for my career. I want to be a pulpit rabbi, and that means that I'm going to have, and I want to be able to be a rabbi for many different types of people and build trust. But in the Jewish community, there's so often like a purity test around Israel that I can see people really refusing to build relationships with me. And she has spoken to other – I have a number of friends in rabbinical school who have had similar experiences and similar fears. The landscape is changing recently. There have been a few open letters from rabbinical students, but it's hard to know where the line is right now, and it creates great fear in these people. How do you respond to Claire Davidson Miller?
I say to her, I've met several of these rabbinical students and I've just embraced them and wished them well.
Great.
They have no idea how important they are.
Wow.
One of the leaders of JVP is a rabbi of
yes.
the Wise, who is a mm-hmm. rabbi and who has stepped down now. I hope it won't shock anybody listening, but I am 100% atheist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I love these rabbis. Mm-hmm. And I love them not only because they are so central in the Jewish community, but because they are our teachers. They are our storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And we need those stories.
Mm-hmm. You're a good storyteller too. So.
Yeah, but I don't have I don't have a synagogue.
So
just let me get to the chase. It is hard to be representing this point of view in the Jewish community. It was really hard for white people in the South to do anything overt to show that they were supporting black people. It hasn't reached the point where our lives have been threatened. But in the years that I spent out on the street, it got to the point where I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't be called all the names and be met with this hysterical outburst. And it took everything out of me. So it's really hard to do this work.
Okay, let's just make this a little concrete for people. You were that's work, I believe, that you did with Jews Say No on the Upper West Side during various Israeli onslaughts.
Yes.
That a group of you would be holding up signs.
Yes.
And so I guess the very precise questions I need to ask you, because I want to offer a hopeful narrative, I believe there's a hopeful narrative here, actually, was how many years ago was that? These people spat on you at the worst okay, how many years ago was that? And what did the sign say? And do you think that if you were out there with those signs today, that there would be any difference?
Well, it was, Jews Say No probably did it up to about 4 years ago.
Okay.
And of course everything stopped, with COVID. So,
yes.
So,
okay, sorry.
I would say 4 years ago.
Okay.
But there were many, many Jewish demonstrations. I mean, many demonstrations, not just Jews Say No. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the best ones that we ever had was that we had a demonstration that went all around the Waldorf Astoria, went around the.
I was there.
Yes.
I walked.
And that was to protest a dinner for friends of the IDF. You know, we've become accustomed to these really bizarre things like Friends of the IDF. Have you ever heard of an organization that is Friends of the Italian Army? No, you haven't. That's
no.
Because there is none. There is no Friends of the British Army that gets American tax exempt status.
You're cracking me up. How do you explain that? Why can't I say that's a dual loyalty question, you know?
Well, that's a United States foreign policy question. That's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone thinks that Israel is the dog and
that's
the United
funny.
States is the tail. But I say no.
I say
Israel is the tail. And it's the United States wants Israel to be in its camp. And so it's willing to do almost anything. But when it comes down to your own feelings about it, it's hard to put up with this all the time. And I think I told you when I saw you in person that for a long time, I couldn't relate to this issue of privilege, the word privilege, when it was concerned with work, doing political work, because I felt the least privileged person on earth to go out there and be standing there with a sign and people would just come and insult you and not really assault you. We only had a couple of little minor assaults physically, but insult you with everything that they could possibly think of. And the worst thing that happened to me in being called a name was when Donna Neville and I wrote an article to the Old Jewish Currents about BDS. And people went in the comments and they called me a capo.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if your listeners know what a capo is. K-A-P-O.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the worst thing that you can call a Jew. And it is the person who works in Auschwitz who helps the Germans and shovels you into the ovens. So for that person, we were in favor of BDS. Then we were a capos. That was the equivalent. And one time, actually, I saw this Rabbi Shmuley
Boteach.
Yes. He was coming out of a meeting. We were protesting. We protested everywhere. And he came out and he pointed a finger at all of us and he said, "You're a Nazi. You're a Nazi. You're a Nazi."
Unbelievable. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the kind of...
That's abuse.
Yes.
That is heavy abuse. Yes.
Abuse.
But when you speak of privilege, here's how I would answer your privilege point. I would say that the Jewish community is privileged on this question. Let's, without getting into a discussion of the power of the Israel lobby, on which you and I are likely to disagree, I think you and I would agree that Jews have a special place in this discussion in the United States. And unfortunately, Palestinians have the opposite. They have a negative place, but we have a fairly privileged place in this. So as Jews, obviously, you are sacrificing that privilege when you're going out and being called a Nazi by these f***ing idiots.
Well, yes, I don't really want to get bogged down in this also, but
yeah,
we have a special obligation is what
you said. I agree with you.
Okay, so we definitely agree on that. And we have an obligation as members of this community to fight back against this. And I think we have definitely made some headway. No question about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Pew research shows that 30% of Jewish young people no longer think that Israel, you know, is the apex of their existence.
Yes.
And they are separated in some kind of way. So that is a tremendous loss that to the established Jewish community. It can't even be overstated. 30%
of the
people that they are counting on. So things are definitely changing.
Yep.
The Palestinian voice in the past, I would say in the past 10 years, has increased dramatically.
I agree with you.
Now, it hasn't really penetrated mainstream, you know, your favorite Betmore, you know, the New York Times.
Yeah.
It hasn't penetrated them yet. and if there were time, I'd tell you a funny story about the New York Times. But it's bound to sooner or later.
Yes.
So when I said privilege, I meant it in an ironic way.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
That here we were beaten up verbally.
Yes. Yes. I take your point. I take your point. So
and the other thing, could I just say?
Yeah.
Definitely, let's say as a Jew that I would have privilege. As a white person, I have privilege.
Yes.
I mean, my brother is never going to be shot in the back in the United States. So there's no point in trying to deny it.
Yes.
We need to use it.
Yes.
Use it for the common good.
I'm with you.
And that's what we'll be remembered for.
Great. I love it. I love it, Dorothy. And you say that on the basis of a lot of experience. So I want to shift the focus slightly because we're winding up. And I had when I saw you recently, I'm going to try to capture what was very meaningful about our encounter the last time I saw you. And that was that I told you about various comments that had been made to me by family members over the years. And my family, just to be clear, it was never a Zionist family. It's an eccentric academic Jewish family that very unaffiliated in the Jewish communal life. We didn't go to synagogue, that kind of thing. Nonetheless, we were part of a broader, very Jewish cultural community. Most of my parents' friends were Jewish, and their closest friends moved to Israel in 1968. And I related to you that one of the people who moved to Israel, my mother's friend Golda, said to me when she discovered the work I was doing, the anti-Zionist work 15 years ago, she said, "Oh, this is because of your competition and your failed relationship with your father, your hatred of your failed literary career that you have taken to vilifying Jews. This is your family, Mishigas. And I also related to you, I think that my mother once called this the work I do on this website vile. So, and you were a little, you seemed a little surprised that this degree of vituperation would be directed at me. And I think that you also diagnosed in that moment, or my memory of this encounter was, Phil, you've got to liberate yourself from this. This, you've internalized some of this guilt from this family about this. It's holding you back. I can hear it in your voice. Now, I'm not capturing, but so I want you to just, you can say anything you want about me and my family here. And I don't, you know, I'm offering myself up in these personal reflections because I think that they'd be helpful to other people. But can you respond to what I've just said?
Well, when we had that conversation, what I remember was being horrified that your own family members were vilifying you. And since then, I've thought about it. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I do favor psychological interpretation sometimes. What we have here is classic projection. Phil, you are going against the mainstream. And the reality is, Phil, that they are uncomfortable. They are the ones who are uncomfortable. I don't believe that there's any Zionist, if you could hypnotize them, would say to you, yes, I believe that Palestinians are lesser human beings. I just don't believe it. And I think they are sitting on and doing things that are ethically reprehensible that in subconsciously they know and they understand. They don't realize it. And that is what comes from being in an ethnically privileged position. I mean, you know it's wrong. If you read anything, I mean, especially the Americans who went and made Aliyah in Israel, mm-hmm. who were brought up to believe in, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance and equal rights.
Uh-huh. All that stuff.
They are sitting in a situation where you truly have to be ethically blind and deaf and dumb, that you can't realize in some way that you are perpetuating this. Now, they might fight and say, absolutely not. We are the chosen people. God told us and so on, forth and so on. I'm sorry. I don't buy it. And that's why there's all this hysteria. The hysteria is projecting on other people what you know you've done wrong.
Okay.
And that's the reason for the incredible level of vituperation that you're getting. It's not just, Phil, I don't agree with you.
Yeah.
It's, Phil, you are a traitor.
Yeah.
You are a traitor to what we're doing. When in fact, I think that that they know somewhere in their heart of hearts that what they're doing is wrong. Wrong, mm-hmm. wrong, wrong. And I would say the same thing about white people in the South.
Okay, so but let me just shift the frame for a moment here. In 2008, I went to an 2008, I went to an anti-Zionist Seder in Philadelphia, and it was an all-night affair. And there was a workshop in which a lot of people talked about the denunciations and curses they had gotten from their family members. And the most powerful moment of that workshop for me was that as we went around the circle, I offered some self-pity about this stuff that had been directed at me. And after we'd gone through the whole circle, I felt like I was lucky compared to some of these other young people. Okay. You know, a young woman who'd been thrown out of the house, whose father refused to talk to her, whatever. Okay. So I was a minor leaguer compared to some of the, and what I guess I'm shifting the frame from me and my family for a moment and from whatever they're projecting, which I'd like to believe that you're right. Don't you think a lot of young Jews are experiencing this kind of internalization, are taking this on, and are the shame and this guilt? that they're taking it on, and that part of the process is to get them past that, or is that too indulgent?
Well, I think the statistic that we talked about just a few minutes ago is very illustrative of this.
Uh-huh.
If there are 30% of young people who are saying, this is bull, I'm not listening to this. Do not say this to me. I'm doing this and I'm going to go.
I love you, Dorothy.
I'm going to go to school and I'm going to do this. Something deep is happening. Somebody is saying to them, you're living in a dream world. You're living in a dream world. This is a state. And that they could have gotten away with it.
Yes.
Until they passed the nation state law.
Yes.
That was it. That was the coffin that they nailed the coffin shut. That was it.
Well, but just to be clear, when you say they're living in a dream world, these people who believe in this stuff, they are living in the dream.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
I mean, it may happen now
if
the United States is giving them $4 billion a year, and now that they're going to cozy up with all of those people in the, they may feel on the top of the world. That's what I'm saying. I am convinced, I don't know whether you and I will see it, but this is not a stable state. There will be one state.
Beautiful.
Israel.
Okay.
One state. It will have a different name. It will be from the river to the sea. And everyone will have equal rights.
Oh, my God. Oh, God. I'm breaking up. This is so beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful what you're saying. One last question, because I like to end these discussions under an hour. It's fairer to our listeners. Why was the 2018 nation state law giving Jews officially a basic constitutional, higher constitutional rights than just making Arabic a lesser language? Jews have greater rights of settlement. Jews have an exclusive right of self-determination in the land of Israel. This right-wing law that Netanyahu and his friends passed, and his friends are, 80% of Israeli Jewish society. Why was that the nail in the coffin? What did you mean? Why did you bring that in? I thought that was a really important insertion. I don't understand it. Explain it.
Well, before that, it used to be like people like Dershowitz were very fond of saying, oh, Israel is a great democracy. You can argue there. Look at the press. They always have this and that. That he was waving that flag.
Yes.
He's not waving that flag anymore because the Israelis themselves said, we are special. They are lesser. We are better.
Yes.
I mean, how on earth can you make a case for that?
Yeah, yeah.
When they say not only that, but the language issue.
Yeah.
And not only that, finally, there is such a thing as the Israeli Declaration of Independence, which is what Ben-Gurion read on the day that Israel was declared a state, and it isn't a declaration of independence like ours, but it's the closest thing. And inside that declaration, it says, comma, and the rights of other people will not be infringed.
Mm.
So they, in fact, have obviated their own declaration of independence to the extent where I believe it was, I can't remember his name now, an Israeli prominent musician who got an award, and they gave him time to speak. This is all on YouTube. And he chose just to read the Israeli Declaration of Independence.
I didn't know about that.
And the Minister of Education stormed off the stage. How dare he read that?
Wow.
Because in it, it said that other people had rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have a country that this is corrupt. This is corrupt. This cannot last forever. It will not last forever. Never. And the other thing is that there are some Israelis, they're very, very few, who are also starting to talk about one state. And there are people don't realize that there are actually Jewish Israelis who every single day are talking about the Nakba in organizations like Zuchrut and other organizations.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a structure that is on a rotten base. The base is going to collapse. It has to collapse.
Yes.
So, and I think people are finally, I'm so sorry that you took that abuse. It drives me crazy.
I love you. You said that.
I'm ready to come and throttle your answer.
Oh, you're great.
whoever said it to you.
Last point here. Thank you. Thank you. Last point, Dorothy. You have had many chapters in your road as an activist. You've had some surprises in that road. You've had some glory years. You've had some quiet years. You've had re-glory years. How do you feel about the possibility? And I've seen you when you were on that tour, that Great Hillel tour, that Open Hillel tour a few years ago. You know, you were trying to, here you were. It was a beautiful moment. I saw you in Philadelphia, maybe at Swarthmore. And you were, you know, a few of you older Jews were trying to speak about Israel to these young Jews at a Hillel, and they had barred you from going. So you held it on campus anyway. It was a great tour you did, a fantastic tour. Okay. I want you back on those space. I think you were a really convincing speaker. You were such a wonderful presence. You were so warm and intelligent, and, you know, you just hold a space so beautiful. Are you getting any invitations to synagogues? And how would you feel about those invitations? And how would you feel about debating? And
Well, I did debate once years and years ago in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And it was years and years. It was actually the group that got invited was this wonderful group we used to have called Jews Against the Occupation. Mm-hmm. With young people. It dissolved later on. And that was a sort of setup, you know, where they defined the questions. And mm-hmm. I was one of the debaters. And it was very dramatic, too long to go into. No synagogue invites me. If a synagogue invited me, you better believe I would be there.
Beautiful. I want you there.
And I have tried to get my colleagues to go onto these 24-hour Jewish cable stations. Did you know that there were such things?
Yeah, I'm aware of them.
Yes. I want somebody to call up and say, hello, we are Jews too. We want to appear on your cable news.
So you'd go on TV?
Oh yeah.
Great. We need you on TV.
But I'm too old. No.
Banish that thought. Why do you say that?
I have to have younger people.
Of course you have younger people, but you have some older people too.
So let's try the young. I can think of 10 young people who would be great. But in any case, we need to do that. We need to do that. We need to do whatever it takes. Letters to the editor, letters to the foreword, you know, whatever.
Yes.
And we will keep doing that. Yes. Also, JVP has a rabbinical council. Hello. Yes. Rabbinical councils can do things. So, no, we have a lot of resources that we didn't have before. And I'm not, I don't want to be, you know, Susie Sunshine here. This is hard work. But you know what? If you want to live like a mensch, this is the kind of work you need to do.
That's great.
You'll never make money. But it's not boring.
That's fantastic.
Boring is the most terrible thing of all.
Dorothy, I love going out on Susie Sunshine, you know? I never heard that one, but that was great. I love it. I love it. You know what you just said? You know, I don't mean to be too obvious. I feel like you're extending a hand to young people and saying, you want to live a life of meaning and purpose. Oh. There's one way to do that.
Absolutely.
And it's been very fulfilling to you. And it's been a rocky road, too.
Totally. And I have to tell you, I'm ready. And I'm going to go out fighting. I'm going to go out the way I came in. No, I'm serious.
No, I believe you. Dorothy, we're at an hour. I know we're going to continue this discussion down the road. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Anytime. You're one of my heroes.
Back at you.
I forgot to say that Mondo Weiss was a key thing. Can you imagine? I forgot to say that.
That was Dorothy Zellner and Phil Weiss speaking on a Mondo Weiss podcast. The importance of the role that Jews play in challenging the mendacity of the Israeli narrative cannot be overestimated. The charge is largely being led by young Jews who recognize that long-held Jewish values rooted in the prophetic history of their faith, are being trampled by the Zionist movement with the creation of an apartheid state in Israel. The values of the civil rights, equal rights, climate rights, and anti-war movements over the past few decades are taking root in a new generation of young people, and they are taking on the struggle for more humane and just society, including Israel, and often in conflict with their parents and the older generations who created this mess. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. You can also stream us live every Friday morning at kkrn.org. That's kkrn.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.